Welcome to the 11kpw podcast, a data protection update by Christopher Knight. This talk was given at the 11kpw Information Law Conference on the 2nd of March 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
Morning, everyone. The time was when you could do a data protection update in about 5 minutes and still be accused of padding, but not this year. This year, there are more cases to discuss than there are selfies on a Kardashian Twitter feed. And frankly, I don't have time to cover even all of those in even quick form today. So if I've missed your favourite case of the year, please do go back and read what we say about it on Panopticon. And that may sate your enthusiasm slightly. What I am going to try and do today is cover four topics and a funeral. And the funeral is, of course, that of Safe Harbour, which, given the nautical metaphor, is where we should start our voyage. So in case any of you have forgotten, the eighth data protection principle implements Article 25 of the directive, and that states, in essence, that personal data shan't be transferred out of the EU unless where it is going to ensures an adequate level of protection for the rights and freedoms of data subjects in relation to the processing of their personal data. And just pausing there to pick up something that was said in the morning session, that's why Article 25 is one reason why Brexit is not going to mean that we can just ignore the data protection regime, because either we're going to be still within the EA in a Norway sense and so be bound by the directive, or if we're completely outside, we're going to have to be ensuring that we provide an adequate level of protection in order that our European friends and partners can send us data. Now, the eighth principle looks like quite a formidable bar. There are ways round it. There are a series of specific exemptions in Schedule 4 of the DPA, principally, of course, consent. But there are other methods as well, the standard contract clauses. There are only certain limited models that have been drafted by the European Commission, and they're not always as flexible as a lot of users would like. There are binding corporate rules, which can help if you're looking at intra-corporate group transfers of personal data. But they require regulatory approval, and that can take a long time, and up to a year at least. Or you could rely on a decision of the Commission that the particular territory to which transfer was going provided adequate protection. And in the case of the US, that decision was the Safe Harbour decision. And that takes us on to the Schrems judgment. Mr. Schrems has a vendetta against a lot of people, but in particular Facebook. And the reason why Facebook is involved is because Facebook transfers all of the personal data that you input onto that site from its servers in Ireland. Basically, every account that isn't in the US and Canada is dealt with through its Irish servers, and it's transferred to its US servers. And following the Snowden revelations about American data access, Mr. Schrems complained to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner that Facebook's transfers of personal data to the US did not ensure an adequate level of protection for his personal data. Irish Data Protection Commissioner said, safe harbour is in place, get lost. And then the question went on appeal to the Irish courts and referred to the Court of Justice. Was safe harbour enough of an answer to deal with the concerns about American levels of protection? No, says the Court of Justice. And in particular, and this is really the sort of core point of the, in a way, of the judgment, national data protection regulators are under an obligation to make their own assessment of the levels of protection. You cannot, as the Irish Commissioner had said, just respond to a complaint by saying, Commission says no. You've got to investigate in a little bit more detail and reach your own view. But the court went beyond that. Now, traditionally, the Court of Justice has been very reluctant to say anything more than it absolutely has to decide a case. But in Schrems, it was willing to go the next step and say not only were you required to carry out your own level of protection, but it, in fact, the safe harbour decision on which you purported to rely, Irish Data Protection Commissioner, was not adequate. It did not ensure adequate levels of protection. And the particular concerns that the court had were around US blanket covert surveillance infringing privacy rights, both contained in the general law and in the European Charter, and a lack of a complaints redress mechanism to ensure effective judicial protection of data protection rights. So not only did Mr. Schrems win on the narrow point, the Court of Justice also struck down the safe harbour decision. Now, that poses a major procedural problem, because loads of data controllers transfer data to America all the time. It is not just big companies like Facebook, Google, or big multinational corporations. Lots of smaller companies do. Lots of transfers into the cloud, for example, are transfers onto US servers. And in principle, those are transfers which are no longer protected by the safe harbour regime. The Article 29 Working Party gave, which is the collection of European data protection regulators, gave the Commission time to come up with a replacement to safe harbour before it started laying down the law, which might be thought slightly surprising, as the Commission had been supposedly negotiating a replacement for safe harbour for about 2.5 years already. But the Article 29 Working Party also noted that the fact that safe harbour was gone also cast some doubt on the other mechanisms that the Commission was encouraging data controllers to use instead of safe harbour, the standard contract clauses and the binding corporate rules. And the point of concern is, after all, if the US government can effectively hack your iPhone and get your data from it, what use are binding corporate rules in protecting you? And at the moment, it remains a delicately unanswered question precisely how effective standard contract clauses and binding corporate rules really are in dealing with the welter of concerns that the Court of Justice had about the American levels of protection. But then, at the beginning of February, when all hopes looked lost, came something over the horizon. And it was neither a bird nor was it a plane. It was the EU-US Privacy Shield, which I'm afraid to say is its real name and not a joke. Now, the next slide purported to say a bit about what that February announcement set out. But in fact, in much the same way as the Burns Commission ruined Andrew's evening, the Commission has ruined my evening by announcing on Monday that it had drafted a draft adequacy decision. So at the beginning of February, it was just an announcement of what they might get round to. End of last week, the US passed the Judicial Redress Act, and on Monday, the Commission published its draft adequacy decision. Now, it is mostly garbage. But the highlights, for those of you who care, are that that US companies which want to be on the Privacy Shield list must agree to protect the privacy principles, which in short terms are broadly the principles that one sees in the Data Protection Directive. And if you, as the data subject, don't think that your Privacy Shield list controller has complied with those principles, then the company has to give you a response to your complaint within 45 days. It has to offer you a free alternative dispute resolution service. You can complain to Mummy, namely the Information Commissioner, who will tell Teacher on them, namely the Department of Commerce, about this naughty American bully. And if none of that works, then there is, in theory, supposed to be some mechanism by which the data subject and the US data controller appoints arbitrators from the Privacy Shield panel to determine the dispute. Now, all of this sets out all these sort of different ways in which you might be able to air your complaint. None of them include going before a court and having a judge decide, and that's obviously going to be the major potential hole. And if you're a data subject who is still worried about the Snowden revelations and the various data gathering surveillance operations that Rupert will be talking about at the end of today, well, the Department of Commerce and Secretary of State John Kerry have provided a very nice letter to the Commission promising that data will only be accessed by the US authorities lawfully and when necessary and appropriate. So that's nice. And the Commission goes on, gives an umpteen-page account of all of the different oversight mechanisms there are within the US system over the intelligence agencies, none of which, of course, had achieved anything useful at all in relation to these data-gathering exercises that were the subject of the Snowden revelations. And if, for some unaccountable reason, you aren't convinced by those oversight mechanisms, i.e. the president saying they'll be nicer in future, then the point of the Privacy Shield is they're going to set up a Privacy Shield ombudsperson who is going to look at complaints that are funneled to the ombudsperson by the National Data Protection Regulator, so here the Commissioner. Buried in a footnote to the adequacy decision is the information that the ombudsperson will neither confirm nor deny whether the data subject has in fact been the subject of surveillance. So again, there are obviously question marks about how adequate this route is going to be. It's safe to say that as soon as at the point at which this decision, adequacy decision, is finalised and published and comes into force, a challenge is not going to be long behind it, and that challenge may well be successful on the application of the principles set out in Schrems. But in a world where Wurzel Gummidge can be Mayor of London and Donald Trump can win Super Tuesday, literally anything can happen. A key point is that at the moment, like Pitt the youngest, this is all still a glint in the Commission's eye. There is no authorised adequate level of protection for data transfers to the US. All of this is still in theory and in draft. But the current position is that the Article 29 Working Party position and our own Information Commissioner are continuing with a sort of slightly nebulous grace period within which they aren't going to do very much by way of enforcement. That isn't necessarily the position of all European regulators. The Germans have started enforcing against data controllers who are still transferring to the US, purporting to rely on the Safe Harbour Agreement. And so it's going to be interesting to see how long the Commission are given to finalise the new rules before enforcement action is taken, and then what action is taken in relation to standard contract clauses, binding corporate rules, and so on. Right, moving on from the sexy and headline-grabbing Schrems stuff to privacy notices, which are about as sexy as an Andy McDowell film. Barra is a very important Court of Justice decision which has tended to slip under the radar for lots of people. And what Barra does is impugn the transfer of data between, as it happened in that case, two public authorities. There was no legal requirement for the health insurance fund of Romania to transfer personal data to the tax authorities in Romania. But more importantly, there was no express consent from the data subjects, and data subjects had not been given any notice that that processing might occur. And the Court of Justice held that that was in breach of the directive, in particular Article 10. And that is a really important reminder of the practical importance of making sure you have clear consent and in keeping your data subjects informed of the processing that you are carrying out, because it is not a case restricted to public authorities or the particular factual circumstances of the case. It's a very wide-ranging principle. And much the same point was being emphasised in Optical Express, a case that Robin was in for the Commissioner. That was a case all about receiving spam text messages selling laser eye surgery. And one of the core questions before the tribunal was whether or not it was sufficient for data protection purposes, those principles being read into the Privacy and Electronic Communications Regulations, that where the data subject had given their details, including their contact details, to Thomas Cook in a post-holiday questionnaire, which at the bottom in very small print said that their details might be passed to a third party, was that sufficient to amount to consent to receiving the spam text messages. And the tribunal, in a fairly lengthy decision, said no, it is important that the data subject provides their consent to the data controller and for the express purposes that the processing is actually going to be for. And the reason for that is a fairly straightforward one. It's not really consent if you don't know what you're consenting to. And frankly, if Optical Express didn't see that coming, then maybe they should have gone to Specsavers. You're a clever and attractive audience, so I'm not going to spend any time on the next... I don't know what people are laughing at there for. It's obviously true. So I'm not going to run through the key principles about dealing with subject access requests, but they're on the slide if any of you feel you need a revision later. I'll move straight to some of the cases on Section 7.9. Section 7.9 imports a general discretion to the court in how to deal, how to resolve, what remedy to award, where someone brings a claim for a breach of their subject access rights under Section 7. Classic statement of principle in the Lord case by Mr. Justice Mumby that Section 7.9 discretion is general and untrammelled. And traditionally, that has been held to mean that basically the courts can use it in more or less whatever way they want, and if they don't like the look of the data subject very much, then they just won't order any relief. Dawson Damer in the High Court adopts pretty much that orthodox line. There, the judge did not like the look of what the subject access request was being used for, namely access to material that might be subject to privilege and certainly might be exempt from disclosure in foreign litigation. And so had it been necessary for him to do so, he would have refused relief under Section 7.9. And the data controller, in that case Taylor Wessing, was entitled to refuse to comply with the request at all. Bit slim on reasoning, but nonetheless a fairly standard approach that the county courts have been adopting to Section 7.9 for a while. The two Met Police cases on the slide take a slightly different approach. Cololo is a case in which the data subject was on death row in Kenya and made a request to the Met Police for files that might assist him in the course of his appeal against conviction and sentence. And he said, one of the things he said was that one of the purposes for this request was in order to check the accuracy of the data. And that was good enough, said Mr. Justice Dingemans. He wasn't going to go behind that statement to check about any broader sense of the purpose of the request and whether or not a request made in the context of litigation was inappropriate. There was no room for Section 7.9 to apply where one of the classic ideas of purposes of the data protection legislation was in play. So it doesn't take very much in that context to get yourself, make sure that you are within the DPA. The Lynn case and the judgment of Mr. Justice Green gives rather more detailed consideration, arguably evisceration, of the classic approach to Section 7.9. That was factually, and I'll come back to the details in later, relatively similar to Cololo. But Mr. Justice Green refused to accept the idea that Section 7.9 allowed sort of open season for the court. He stressed that the court had to exercise the discretion that Section 7.9 had to exercise its Section 7.9 discretion in a way that was bounded by the principles contained within the Act. You couldn't just decide that you couldn't refuse relief based on something that the Act doesn't recognise. In effect, you could only do what the data controller could lawfully have done as the court. And that in some ways is quite a significant move away from a number of the previous more elderly authorities, and it's be interesting to see to what extent that plays out, that is relied upon and by data subjects in the future. Also on data, on subject access requests, a practical problem that many of you will have faced is the degree to which you have to engage in searching for material. Now, Dawson Damer endorsed a previous decision of the county court in a case called Elliott and Lloyd's TSB, which gave the standard of searching to be after a reasonable and proportionate search. And that is wording which first time approved in the High Court by the same judge, I might add. which is slightly different to the statutory wording in Section A2 about involving disproportionate effort, and it's rather lower than the Commissioner's guidance on Section A2, which makes it fairly clear that the Commissioner considers that that disproportionality exception should be a true exceptional category. The context of Dawson-Damer was that the request was going to require lawyers doing a lot of redacting of potentially privileged material out of a wide category of information. And there's at least some hint in the reasoning of His Honour Judge Behrens that Parliament couldn't have intended that to be such a wide search to be the test, because why on earth would lawyers do so much work for just £10? Now, that is certainly the intention of the lawyers. Whether it's the intention of the Act and the directive is another matter. The Itihadie case, which is less directly about Section 8.2 and more incorporating Section 8.2 concerns into a Section 7.9 refusal of relief argument, that's a case about a dispute between neighbours in a block of Chelsea flats. And frankly, the only surprising element of the judgment is that it isn't just the judgment is not just a one paragraph hashtag first world problems case dismissed. It does go into more detail. There, the High Court understood that about 400 pages of information had been disclosed in respect of the subject access request, and what the judge went on to say was that he did not think it was appropriate or proportionate to require further searches of individual email inboxes to see if there might be anything further, particularly without any real indication of what that further information might be. Both of these cases are going to the Court of Appeal at different times, and so all of these points are likely to be up for grabs and no doubt discussed this time next year. Exemptions. Part 4 of the DPA contains a large number of exemptions from the requirement to comply with subject access requests under Section 7 and at least some of the data protection principles as well, depending on which exemption it is. There's not very much case law on the exemptions, and so it is nice to see a rare foray into the light for paragraph 7 of Schedule 10, which is the legally professional privileged exemption, and Section 36, domestic purposes exemption, in Dawson-Damer and Itihadie. I'm going to skip over these two, but you can read about them on the blog if you wish to. As I say, they're both going to the Court of Appeal, so both raise, particularly Dawson-Damer, raises some quite interesting questions about the scope of the exemption, but we'll save it for when we get more authoritative guidance. It is worth, though, spending a little bit more time on the Lynn case, which I mentioned earlier. Now, Lynn is a very sad case, in fact. The data subjects in Lynn were the two Burmese nationals who were on trial and facing the death penalty for the rape and murder of Hannah Witheridge and David Miller, the British backpackers in Thailand. And they made a subject access request to the Met Police for the Met's review that officers had gone out and conducted of the Thai police investigation. Now, the Met, represented by Anya Proops and I, argued that the Section 29 exemption applied to the whole of that report that the Met had produced. Section 29 exemption is for investigation and detection of criminal offences, apprehension and detention of offenders. It's a prejudice exemption, and the way the Met large in summary form put its case was that the prejudice would be to the ability of the Met and other police forces and domestic law enforcement agencies to cooperate in the future with foreign police forces and law enforcement agencies and security services, where it had been forced to divulge information that it had only had access to under detailed assurances of confidentiality. The judgment of Mr. Justice Green is very detailed, and it repays careful reading. But there are a number of things he says about how to go about analysing the DPA exemptions. He makes clear that the burden is on the data controller to establish the exemption, and that will require weighty grounds and evidence. He says that the processing that is in issue must be for the purposes of the exemption, but He also says that those exemptions need not be artificially narrowly construed. And that was relevant in the Lynn case, because at least one of the most expressed purposes for which the Met had produced the report in the first place was for family liaison reasons. And Mr. Justice Green was perfectly happy to say that family liaison reasons fell within the scope of investigation, detection of offences and apprehension of prosecution of offenders. He then goes on to say that when one considers the prejudice test in Section 29 and some of the other exemptions, the way the court should approach that test, particularly in the context here where the data subjects were at risk of the death penalty being imposed on them, was that the court should adopt effectively a fair balance proportionality style analysis. But it was, approving the suggestion of Mr. Justice Mumby and Lord, it was appropriate to look at the wider impact. You didn't have to only look at the impact in the circumstances of the particular case. And it was permissible to make arguments based on a more general chilling effect. And as it happened on the facts, he considered that that chilling effect was made out on the facts and the evidence before the court. The reality you see fairly clearly from the judgment was that the key point for the judge was that had the information contained exculpatory material that might have assisted the data subjects in their criminal trial, he was likely to have found that the proportionality balance favoured disclosure. He didn't see that such material existed, and so he maintained the exemption. You may have seen that on Christmas Eve, the two data subjects were convicted by a Thai court and death penalty was imposed on them, although I think I understand there are appeals on train in Thailand. But it is an unusual case, an unusual data protection case, where one felt that the stakes were genuinely quite high. On enforcement, Section 13, of course, is the big talking point at the moment, and the levels of compensation for damage or distress under Section 13 for breach of the data protection principles or the Act more generally. You will all be familiar with Google and Vidal Hall, and that is off. You will probably also know that it is off to the Supreme Court and will be heard before the summer. Judgment before summer, probably unlikely, probably in the autumn. And the main point before the court is whether or not the Court of Appeal were right to remove the pecuniary loss requirement in Section 13 before you could get damages for distress. There is no appeal on the Court of Appeal's conclusion that there was a serious issue to be tried, that Google's tracking data that allows them to send you personalised adverts to your devices was personal data. That is going to trial, and on that point, C2, the impending decision from the Court of Justice in Breyer about whether IP addresses are personal data. Again, those points, outcome of the trial in Google and Breyer will probably be something we have to come back to this time next year. But there is a big unanswered question as to how the Court of Appeal's decision in Gulati and Mirror Group newspapers reads across to the DPA context. So Gulati is one of the phone hacking cases. Various celebrities brought claims for misuse of private information and other things against the Mirror Group, and Mr. Justice Mann, in a very lengthy first instance judgment, awarded damages from ranging between £85,000 and £260,000 to individuals. And one aspect of those damages awards was a pecuniary award which represented, in Mr. Justice Mann's view, a loss of control over your privacy rights, regardless of any proof of particular damage. So it's a first stage. You get some money for that, and then if you've suffered distress or other damage, then you might get more money, depending on what you can show. That was one aspect of the judgment that was challenged on appeal, and the Court of Appeal, led by Lady Justice Arden, upheld Mr. Justice Mann that was a perfectly proper approach to take to the award of damages. And so there is obviously a potential for that approach to be read across to the DPA, which, as the directive repeatedly reminds us, is essentially a form of specialised privacy right. And it may well be that argument hasn't yet been articulated very clearly, but it's not going to be far away, and it may well deal with the sort of point that's run in Itihadiyeh, where the judge obviously looked at the claimant, who was basically a professional complainer, and says, well, you're no wallflower, you're obviously not distressed by any of this, so I think it's highly unlikely that you're entitled to any damages at all. If Gulati is right, then someone like Mr. Itihadiyeh, who can establish a breach, even if it's not all of the breaches he originally claimed of, might still be entitled to some sort of level of award. Finally, and the other major Court of Justice decision of the last year on enforcement is Weltamo, and that is all about where a data controller is established for the purposes of Article 4 of the directive, and that matters because where you are established, that is that applicable national law can be applied to you, and the particular national regulator can try and take enforcement action against you if you breach the directive and its implementing legislation. In Weltamo, it was a Slovakian company which was operating a property search and property purchase website for Hungarian properties, with a website in Hungarian, taking money from Hungarian customers into a Hungarian bank account with a Hungarian office and an employee in that office to pick up the post. And the Court of Justice held that there was an establishment in Hungary for the purposes of Article 4. The real interest of Weltamo is the test that the Court of Justice sets out for other cases. And there, as is ever the case, the Court of Justice helps us out rather less because the test is really quite vague. They do make clear that even minimal activity will be sufficient within a particular member state to count as an establishment. But there is going to have to be quite a lot of case law which tests the application of the reasoning in Weltamo to separate facts, and the court gives you very little indication of how minimal is minimal enough not to count as an establishment. Is it enough to have physical presence? If you don't have a physical presence, will that mean you avoid it? How important is the bank account? But it does have an obviously serious impact on sites like Amazon and any, frankly, website which is targeted to particular member states. There are also implications from the judgment about what actions the particular national regulators can take, but we'll leave that to one side for the moment. I have somewhat rattled through those slides and the present state of data protection. So I apologise for taking some of it quite quickly, but I'm conscious that I need to leave some time for Robin, who is going to come on and do the new regulation in his capacity as the ghost of Christmas future.